All right, well, we want to welcome everyone to the Mary Haik and Dumont University here at ASBE. And we also want to thank our special sponsors for this particular series, that is Phil and Barbara Lieberman. It's fortuitous that just today happened to be yahrzeit for Herman Lieberman, because this year is also in his memory and his wife Dora. Herman was Chaim Binyamin ben David. He's a Chor Baruch, may his memory be a blessing. Again, we thank Rachel, for what's been a wonderful series. Thank you. Thank you all for joining us.
Can I just say one thing? I'm sorry, but it's Lenny Marvis. Tonight is my grandfather's yahrzeit, and his name was Eliyahu HaKohen. So I just want to acknowledge him and learn in his memory.
Thank you. Eliyahu HaKohen. Wow. It's interesting because, as I mentioned in the opening shiur, there is Eliyahu is a mysterious character. He's mysterious on the way in, mysterious on the way out, mysterious all the way through. And we're going to get to all the way out tonight. But Eliyahu's tribal identity is something of a mystery also, because we don't know anything about it. We don't know his parents or anything. So the simple reading, like we said back then, was 2 weeks ago, was that he's from Shevet Gad because he comes from Gilad, in the town of Toshet. There is a midrash that he's from Shevet Binyamin, actually. And there is also another midrashic tradition that he's from Shevet Levi. And this connects with the midrashic tradition that Eliyahu is Pinchas. What that means is unclear. Does it mean that Pinchas' spirit is in Eliyahu? Is it reincarnation? Is it that Eliyahu continues the same approach and attitude of Pinchas? You'll find every opinion under the sun out there. But the Eliyahu Kohen is a great name to have then. It's great. The reason I didn't provide you with source sheets today is because we did chapter 17, 18, and 19 contiguous, the three chapters that hold the story of Eliyahu, part one. And I called it Eliyahu Man of Fire. Because as you saw, everything about Eliyahu was loud, was exciting, was dynamic. We're not done with that. But something changed in the last scene. If you recall, at the end in Perek Yutet, Eliyahu comes to Har Chorev. He comes into the cave. And of course, Baruch Hu asks him, we have to do this recap because this is probably the central moment in Eliyahu's career. Eliyahu has just had his big moment on Har Carmel, and the whole people fall on their face, said, Adonai Elohim, Adonai Elohim. And Eliyahu then has a contract down on his head. And it seems that nobody's really supporting him. All the people who fell on their face still aren't supporting him. And he runs away and he wants to die. And the Malach pushes him and he goes to Har Sinai. 40 days, he walks, he gets to Har Sinai. Gets to Har Sinai, he comes into the cave. And Hashem asks him, what are you doing here? And he has his answer that we saw last week, which is, I'm the only one left. I'm zealous for you. And they want to kill me. And they've destroyed the Mizbachot. And I'm the only one left. HaKadosh Baruch Hu then says, okay, I want you to step outside. There's going to be a hurricane. I'm not in the hurricane. There's going to be an earthquake. I'm not in the earthquake. There's going to be a conflagration. What before World War II we used to refer to as a Holocaust, a huge fire. I'm not in the fire. And then there will be a still silent voice in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to be teaching something to Eliyahu, which is that at least sometimes, if not all the time, you need to speak to the people with a still silent voice, not with the fire and the brimstone. So Eliyahu experiences all these things, and he hears the still silent voice. And then God asks him the same question, what are you doing here? And Eliyahu gives the same answer, which basically means that Eliyahu didn't get it. He didn't get the message. So on the spot, God fires him. It's the only Navi that we know of who gets fired. There's Navim who quit. There's Navim who take to the job. He's the only Navi gets fired. And God says, I want you to go to Damascus and anoint the new Syrian king, which is bizarre in and of itself. But for that, we'd have to study Elisha to see how that plays out. Then I want you to anoint a new Jewish king over Yisrael, Yehu. And then anoint a new Navi in your place. You're fired. So Eliyahu comes to, does not do what God tells him. Now, how do we justify Eliyahu not doing what God told him? We'd have to say, unless Eliyahu is suddenly a renegade, is that Eliyahu realized the lesson a little bit late. and is trying to curry favor and retain his job. So he doesn't go and do those things God said to him, but he does go to the Navi he was supposed to take as his replacement, and instead takes him as a disciple. And now Eliyahu has Elisha with him. Elisha will not play an active role till the end, but he's got a disciple with him, Elisha. Okay. From here on in, Eliyahu is going to be a changed person. Not totally, but somewhat changed. Now, the reason I didn't give you a handout, because the handout would have been 14 pages long, because we need to look at two chapters that don't have Eliyahu in them at all. We'll look at them very briefly, because they're interjections and they're interruptions in the Eliyahu story if we're reading the Eliyahu story. We're not. We're reading Sefer Malachim. And at Sefer Malachim, they're part of the flow of the story. Chapter 20, which you're looking at right now, and chapter 22, which ends the first book of Malachim, don't mention Eliyahu at all. One little mention in Chafet as an aside. So I'll just sum up what happens. Perek Chaf and Perek Chafet are two major wars that Ahav fights against Aram, Syria, the constant enemy. However, there's something very strange happens in the first war. In the first war, starts out with the Syrian king making demands on Ahab, which are humiliating, and Ahab capitulating. And finally, when it gets too humiliating, Ahab finally says no, and the king of Syria is laughing and drinking and saying, that's all right, I'm going to wipe you out anyways. And God helps Ahab, and they win. And then the Syrians say, well, yeah, their God is a god of the mountains. Let's fight them in the valley. We'll see if they can win. And so Ahav, so the Navi, a Navi, an unknown Navi, comes up to Ahav and says you're going to win anyways, and you're going to beat Aram. And they beat Aram, and they wipe him out, and it's a glorious victory. And then a very disturbing thing happens. Ahav, the king who won, is looking for his vanquished enemy, Ben-Hadad. And the Ben-Hadad's men say to their king, they say, and you see it here in verse 31, you know, the Jewish kings are sweeties, they're softies, right? Let's go come in clothes of mourning, and maybe you'll live. So surprise, surprise to everybody. They get the message to Ahav that Ben-Hadad is still alive. He says, really? He says, Achihu, he's my brother. And they go and they get the two of them together, and Ahav lifts Ben-Hadad up onto his chariot, and he says, we're going to make an agreement. The cities that your father took from me, we're going to return to me, fine. But in the meantime, he's Achi. And this is a very strange move. And without a little bit of world history, it's indecipherable. What happens here, though, is that an Ish Elohim, one of the Nevi'im, unnamed Nevi'im, goes through a whole charade, and then he appears in front of Ahav on the road, and he comes to the king and says, please, Hatzilam, please save me. And he's all beaten up. And Ahav says, what's wrong? He says, I was asked to watch one of the Syrian prisoners, and my commander told me that I had to watch him with my life. And I turned around and he was gone. And so the implication is my commander beat me up. And Ahav says, you deserve what you got. You didn't do your job. And so he turns around and says, what about you? God handed the king over to you and you let him go. So Ahav is very, very upset, which is going to set the scene for the next paragraph we'll look at. However, there's some external history, it's not in Tanakh, that's vital for understanding this. Aram is big. Israel is small, Yehuda is smaller, but in the scheme of things, they are all small. Who is big in these days? This is 8th century BC, 9th century BC. Who is big in these days? There's an empire, perhaps the first empire in the Middle East, called Assyria. It's not really an empire, because it doesn't operate like an empire, but the Assyrian Empire had its ups and downs over several hundred years. It's going to be on the rise. And the Assyrian Empire is now going to battle. And believe it or not, there's a coalition of Yehuda, Israel, Ammon, Moab, Aram, all joining together to fight against Ashur. And we have a record of it actually from Assyrian texts that record the amount of men and horses and chariots that Ahab had. And so we now understand why Ahab was so kind to the king of Syria, because they have a much bigger enemy to worry about. The enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? And so you and I are both enemies to Ashur. We're going to form a relationship. So that's kind of the background of that. And that takes us through Perek Kaf, which again, Eliyahu does not appear in. Perek Kaf Aleph is a very strange interlude, and Eliyahu appears in here briefly, but powerfully. I'll tell you the story quickly, and then we'll look at Eliyahu. Ahav, as you remember, comes home and he's upset. He's upset because he made the politically right move, but the Navi still doesn't. By the way, Ahav can never, never catch a break. Thank you. He can never catch a break from the Navi. Whatever he does, it's wrong. He sneezes the wrong way. It doesn't matter. So Eliyahu, acted in its way towards the king of Aram and mollified him, and they made a brit. And although politically it was the wise choice, religiously it was not, because God had given them the victory of Aram, and they should have been dealt with it that way. So Ahab comes home and he's upset. He comes home, and then we hear this story. Now Ahab does not live in Shomron. Ahab's home is in a town called Yisrael. In Yisrael, Emek Yisrael, Ahav has a neighbor. The neighbor is named Navot. He's a neighbor. And you're going to hear something here which just flies in the face of everything that we sort of thought about Ahav and about eminent domain. Ahav comes up to Navot and says, "You have a nice vineyard. I'd like to buy it from you." Notice, I'm not taking it from you. "I'd like to buy it from you if you'll be agreeable. And I'll either give you money or I'll give you a better vineyard somewhere else. But it's right next to my palace. I want to enlarge my grounds." Now, right away, we're surprised. I don't know about you, but the first time I read this, I was very surprised. Because why doesn't Ahab just take it? That's not how things are done. And Navot refuses, which is also surprising. You say no to the king. And it's Ahab, who's a powerful king. It tells us something about Ahab. The picture of Ahab is not complete. Maybe Ahab is not such a terrible guy, and maybe he's not as bloodthirsty as he seems. In any case, Navot refuses to sell it to him, and Ahab comes home and pouts. Enter Izebel, who we all hate. Izebel walks in, sees him pouting, and tells her the story, and she says, you be a king, I'll take care of it. What does she do? She rigs up a kangaroo court. She hires some false witnesses. They testify that Navot cursed God and cursed the king. And because he cursed God, he's going to die. But because he cursed the king, that means that his property becomes forfeit to the king. Ahab doesn't know what's going on. He's not aware of it. He's pouting in bed. Izebel arranges this. Navot is killed. And then Izebel walks in and says to Ahab, "Don't worry about the vineyard. It's yours. Navot's dead." So Ahab goes to inspect his property. Now, please watch carefully as we see the change in Eliyahu. Eliyahu appears in Pasuk Yod Zayin. Right? So notice, remember when we first met Eliyahu, Eliyahu initiated the statement. Eliyahu said, "I'm Eliyahu, and I'm saying there's no more rain." Hashem speaks to Eliyahu and says, "Kum reid likrat Ahav, melech Yisrael, asher b'shomron, hinei b'cherem navot asher ad sham l'vishto." So go down, and you can see the English here. This is what I want you to say. And these three words echo through history. They're powerful words. And I picture Eliyahu thundering when he says this. But Eliyahu is not saying it. He's quoting God. The words are coming from Eliyahu's mouth. But the Ko Amar Adonai is critical, because we don't have that earlier in Eliyahu's speech. Now Eliyahu is properly a spokesperson for God. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. You murder and you're also inheriting? Right? And then there's more information. God says that the place where they licked, the dogs licked up the blood of Navot, they're going to lick up your blood. Right? And Ahab surprisingly accepts it. Now, this is interesting because in all of their interactions before, it was always adversarial, even when Eliyahu brought rain. Ahab didn't turn to Eliyahu and said, Shkoyach. At this point, something has changed. Ahab turns and said, Hamatzat, Mi'oivi, my enemy found me, really, I'm guilty. And Eliyahu says, Matzati Yani Makarchal Sotara Bini Adonai, because you've sold yourself essentially in doing wrong, which is in God's eyes. And therefore, God says you're going to be wiped out, right? And you're going to end up like your Avam ben Nevat and Basha. In other words, the previous two dynasties of the north wiped out, and Ezebel is also going to be eaten up, right? Now, watch what happens here. It's powerful because it also reflects back to Eliyahu. Pasuk Chav Zayin. V'hichishmo Achav et hadvarim ha'ela. When Achav hears this, v'hikrab gadav, he tears his clothes. V'yasim stakal b'sarom. He puts sackcloth on, and he fasts. He sits down on the ground. When he walks slowly. He is basically contrite. He is accepting God's decree. And this is a marvelous revolution in a king who we really didn't have much use for. Why did it happen? So it could be because Ahav himself realized that his wife had gone overboard and she was calling the shots. She arranged the whole keg record. He knew nothing about it. But there may be something else going on. It may be the case that Ahav heard Eliyahu because Eliyahu didn't speak with fire. He spoke strongly. But Eliyahu perhaps had learned the lesson on Har Sinai that you can't do it with fire and earthquakes and hurricanes. You got to sometimes use a still silent voice. And maybe Eliyahu now sees it works with Ahav. Now we're not done. And Ahav here is then given a reprieve by God. And that is that Ahav will be able to live. He will die as a king, although not at an old age. And his son will be king, and then his son will be the end of the dynasty. In other words, the main point of a king is the dynasty. For a dynasty to exist, a king has to die and the son has to take over. So the dynasty will exist, and that's God's response to Ahav's contrition. Yeah, Rabbi Finkelstein, you had a question.
Can you call it a soft voice when he says, these terrible predictions of how the blood will be licked up and all that?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Somebody's got some sound. I don't know if we need to silence people, but there's some... So a lot of sound going on there. So I hear what you're saying, and I'm bothered by it also. But a still silent voice doesn't mean you say soft things necessarily. But you notice how Eliyahu at the beginning is thundering in the sense that it is Eliyahu's own words. And when Eliyahu speaks to the people, he's at first adversarial. When he speaks to Ahab, he's at first adversarial. Everything is me against you. There's no even dialogue going on. You notice that even the powerful words that Eliyahu uses here are still a question. They may be a rhetorical question, but they're at least a question. Hatzachta v'gam yarashta, which leaves open a door. Now, it's not Eliyahu seeing kumbaya. It's not Eliyahu, to follow the flowers in his hair. But Eliyahu has taken it down a notch. You're going to see this happen a little bit more. But you're also going to see that Eliyahu's success becomes more manifest as a result, right? Now, I agree. Atzach v'gam yarashta is not folk guitar. It is powerful words. But it's nothing of the same tone as we had earlier on when it's Eliyahu on his own making a declaration without there even being an interaction. And bottom line, Ahab did respond that way, which he hadn't responded that way at all earlier. So it seems like it was successful. Now, we move to Perek Chav, although I recognize the question. I see the validity to it in it, and it needs to be dealt with. Agreed. We move to Perek Chav Bet, which in the Christian division of, this is all a Christian division, these chapter divisions, and the Christian division of Kings 1 and Kings 2 is really a poor place. You all know that that's not a Jewish division. The chapter division and the Kings 1, Kings 2, where that divides, is not ours. And we're stuck with it, but that's for reasons of... it's another story why we're stuck with it. But What we hear in chapter 22 is essentially a pickup from chapter 20, which is 3 years later, there's another war between Aram and Yisrael. Now, this is after the war that they fought in Carchemish against Assyria. And so now there's another war. And this war, there's not going to be any treaty at the end. But an interesting thing happens. The king of Yehuda comes up to Yisrael and makes a treaty and agrees to fight with Ahav. Yehoshaphat, who's one of the kings that we regard as being a good guy, comes and makes a treat with Yehoshaphat. Right, they're going to join together. And there's an interesting story here about the Nevi'im. Ahav has 400 court Nevi'im. They all tell him, Shkoyach, go, you're going to be fine. And then there's one Navi, who it turns out is the one Navi Haimet. Remember, we talked last week about the Nevi'im who eat at the table of the king. There's one Navi who's an outsider. He's not bought by anybody. He tells the truth. And his statement essentially is that Ahav, God's trying to find a way to get you killed. You go to war against Aram now, you're going to die. So an interesting story happens here is, and Eliyahu is not in this parak at all. They go out to war, and I'm going to slide ahead already while I tell you this. They go out to war and against Aram, and Ahav is in the chariot, in his chariot, and the Arami soldiers are told to stay their hand. And then one army soldier by accident shoots an arrow and it nails Ahav. Ahav then does something very valiant. He says to his driver, take me back because I've been injured. But he stands up in the chariot as if he's still at war while he's bleeding to death. And remains that way all the way till they get back. He dies. But as a result of his bravery, the Aramim were scared off, and we won the war. At least there was a stalemate. So Ahav dies a hero. We generally don't give him credit for that. But when, and this is what we see at the end of the story, is that when he, I'll show you quickly, when he dies there, right, here is the one line that connects us to Eliyahu. So the dogs lap up Ahav's blood, just like God said. Now notice, just like God said, through whom? Through Eliyahu. And again, that's the critical difference that's happened here, is Eliyahu now is seen simply as a spokesman of God, not as his own man on fire. Okay. So we move ahead to the first chapter of 2 Kings. Again, it's an awkward piece. And we see Eliyahu in a different guise here. Every time that we've met Eliyahu now, Eliyahu has been the one to initiate the interaction. Eliyahu walks out and says, no more rain. Eliyahu comes to the woman in Tzarfat and says, give me some food. Eliyahu comes to Ahav and says, let's go to Har Carmel. Right? Eliyahu approaches Ahav in the Kerem and says, you're going to die because of what you did. Now, again, there's a shift, and Eliyahu becomes a little bit more, shall we say, reserved. Not so reserved in what he says, but in the setting. Here we go. Ahaziah is the son of Ahav. He takes over for Ahav. He'll be the last one in that, or that generation will be the last one in the chain. And so we have a backstory, which is not important for us right now, that Moab, just an interesting thing about in Tanakh, Vaifsha Moab Israel. How would you translate the word Pesha? And they have their translation, and we have to explain what it means. What is a Pesha? We know the word from Dominic, especially Yamin Noraim. Right? What is a Pesha?
Sin brazenly.
What?
It's a brazen sort of sin.
Okay. So Pesha really means rebellion, and it's actually a political word. And you see it here, Vaifsha Moab Israel. Moab rebelled against Israel. What does it mean to rebel? So we have to remember that in David's time, David had conquered the whole East Bank and all the way to the Euphrates. And all of those nations were subservient to the Judean kingdom and paid tribute. And at different times, we lost control over that. Moab was under the hegemony of Israel during this time, and then they rebelled. And by the way, what's the one way you rebel? I'll take you back. What's the famous rebellion that takes place in Breishit? There's a national political rebellion that takes place in Breishit. You remember it?
The four and five kings.
Right. The five kings are not the only ones. There's dozens of kings of little hamlets who rebel. How do they rebel against the four empires of the East? What's in their rebellion? They start throwing Molotov cocktails? What does it mean?
No,
very simple.
It was a tribute.
They stopped paying taxes. That's it. They stopped paying taxes. Right? Same thing here. Moab stops paying taxes to Israel after Ahab dies. Because their sense is Ahab was powerful. We're afraid of him. Now, well, this kid is a yutz. Nothing. No big deal. We don't pay taxes. So they don't pay taxes. And this is only going to come up after Eliyahu is gone as a player. It's foreshadowing. Now, Ahaziah falls and becomes sick. What happens? He sends messengers. Now, Ahaziah's mom is Izebel. L'chu dirshu b'Baal Zvuv Elohei Akron. Go seek out from Baal Zvuv, who is the god of the town of Ekron, if I'm going to live. Now, who's Baal Zvuv? So I think we mentioned this two times ago, that the Baal of the Phoenicians, the Baalim are all over Canaan. The Baal of the Phoenicians, or the most popular Baal of the Phoenicians, was called Baal Zavul. Baal Zavul means master of the high place. Tanakh likes to make fun of Avodah Zarah. And so Tanakh, instead of Baal Zavul, calls him Baal Zavuv.
Zavuv, I see, right? Okay.
Right, so instead of Lord of the High Place, he's Lord of the Flies. And high school boys forever have been tortured by that one. In any case, so Ahaziah sends messengers to go to Ekron. Now, Ekron is on the coast. Well, Ekron, by the way, is south on the coast. Why is Ahaziah going there? Because we have to remember that the Phoenicians and the Philistines are related. And so the whole coastal region has sort of one set of gods. Ahaziah wants to find out if he's going to live, so he sends a messenger to Baal Zavul to seek of the priest of Baal Zavul he's going to live. Why Baal Zavul? Because that's his mom's god. His mom, by the way, is still alive. Now, if you go from Emek Yisrael to the city of Aza, how are you going to go? If you drive today from Yisrael to Aza, how are you going to go? So if you go today, what?
Maybe
Sichel. Say again, right?
By Aza, what is Gaza today?
Right, because Ekron is in the same area.
To the south.
How would you go? So today from Israel, you get on Route 6, you take Route 6 down, and then you get off and take one of the smaller roads. In the times of Tanakh, how would you go? You would go to the coast.
Right.
Right? Go to the coast and go down the coast, because first of all, you got better weather, you'll have access to resources, and you'll have flatter land. So you go to the coast. If you go to the coast from Israel, you're going right underneath Haifa. Keep that in mind. Here's we go.
Okay.
Notice, Eliyahu does not initiate this. A malach tells him, you go up and meet his malach. Meaning, he's sending agents, I'm sending you as an agent. But the Daber Aleihem, and this is the message. Hamibli en Elohim be Israel, atem ochim lidrosh v'val zuv elamei akron. But we have no God of our own. You have to go ask some foreign God if you're going to live. V'lachen ko amar Adonai. And watch, here we go. You're going to give a message from God. And again, this is the real change in Eliyahu. Hamita asher alit asham lo tered v'alei. You're not ever getting out of that bed. Kimot tamud because you're going to die. Eliyahu goes to do this. By the way, notice his name is spelled Eliyah here. There's five times in Tanakh that his name is spelled Eliyah. And there's a beautiful midrash. Mm-hmm. There are five times in Tanakh that Yaakov's name is spelled with a vav.
Name with it.
And the midrash is that Yaakov said, I'm taking your vav hostage until you come and redeem my children. Beautiful midrash. Okay. Vayashuvu malachim elab. So the malachim come back because they Eliyahu greets them and gives them this message, and they turn around and they don't go to Ekron, they come back to to Ahaziah. Now, by the way, where did they meet Eliyahu? They met Eliyahu evidently at Har Carmel. That's where he's hanging out. Right? Vayimrelav ish alali kratenu vayomer elenu lechu shuvu al melech asher shalach etchem. There's the reason we came back, because a man greeted us and he told us. Man greeted us. Said v'dibratem elav ko amar Adonai hamibli and olim Yisrael atar shalach lidrosh val zuv al ha'akron. The message. You're going to die. So the king now hears that because he sent messengers to Elohe Akron and not to Elohe Israel, he's going to die. Now, what should Ahaziah do at that point? You're Ahaziah, you get this message. You just sent, you're the king. You sent your messengers. By the way, you're the king who's the son of a very strong king who died in battle. And you're not very strong. Right, so what should you do when you send messengers to go inquire of the local idols if you're going to live, and they come back with this message? What would you do?
Wouldn't believe it. You do not believe them.
Yeah, you'd say, I don't believe you, and turn around and do what I tell you. He does something else. He says, Vaydevaralim, mem mishpata ish asher alali kratchem. Now, the word mishpat's an interesting word. I want to spend a minute on it. The word mishpat normally means what? Mishpat.
How does it look like?
Mishpat. Well, what does mishpat normally mean?
Justice or laws.
Right. You know? Normally, it's justice or laws. Right. Ela mishpatim. But we find the word used several times in Tanakh when it refers to common custom. For instance, at the beginning of Shmuel, when there's a description of the horrendous behavior of Hophni and Pinchas, Eli's sons, he said, "Vizem mishpat ha-kohanim." They weren't following the law. You talk about the terrible practices. So here it says, Mishpat Ha'ish, what's his custom? What's he like, this guy? Shalali Kratchem, by the Baral Lechem Tad Vaymele. What kind of guy is this? I mean, it could be some crazy guy on the road. Why are you listening? Ruelav, Ish Baal Seyar. He's a man with a lot of hair. Vezor Ora Zur Montnav. And he's got a leather sash around his waist. Now, this guy looks like some mountain character. By Omar Eliyahu Tishbihu.
He recognize him.
Well, and how does he recognize him?
Probably his father told him before, or whatever.
Could be. Or Eliyahu's got a reputation out there. Eliyahu, by the way, remember, had a reputation. We heard about that last week. But Ovadiyahu said to him, I'm going to go tell Ahab that you're here, and then you're going to go fly in the wind somewhere. Eliyahu is this man of mystery, and there's probably lots of stories about him that get exaggerated, because that's what happens with things like that. But in the meantime, guys like that who are wearing leather loincloths and who are hairy people are not common. And for a guy like that to deliver a message like that, Ahaziah puts two and two together and says, that's Eliyahu. My father's nemesis. All right, that's Eliyahu. Now that you know it's Eliyahu and you know what Eliyahu can do, what would you do if you're Ahaziah? What would you do? I know what I would do. What I would do is say, you know what? I got caught. I'm busted. Go to Eliyahu and ask him to please find out from Hashem if I'm going to live. But you know what? Beliefs don't go away very quickly. Matter of fact, beliefs just don't go away. You can't really convince somebody. That's why Ahav's contrition is so remarkable. Again, I'm not trying to make Ahav put his face on Mount Rushmore. I'm just trying to point out that Ahav has a lot of redeeming qualities. Right? And so take a look. So now Ahaziah sends a 50-man battalion. Now this is no longer a message to the gods to find out if Ahaziah is going to win, going to live. This is a group now to come and get Eliyahu. Now watch what happens. He's sitting on top of the mountain. And the guy says, the head of the thing says, Ish Elohim, man of God, the king said, come down. I want you to hear the internal contradiction in those words. You're a man of God, and the king said, come down. Well, if I'm a man of God, that means I call the shots, you don't. And Eliyahu basically says that. If I'm really a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and eat you and devour you guys all up. Now, Eliyahu still is the man of fire. But notice that this is now a responsive and not proactive fire. He's on top of the mountain. They're coming, and they're coming with this whole convoluted perspective, which is, we're going to check out the local idols and see if our king will live. The king has ordered us to do this. And the king has ordered us to bring you down from the mountain, bring you to the king. Really? If I'm a man of God, guess what? And what happens? Remember this fire from heaven, it's going to come back. Now what happens? Who comes back to Ahaziah to report what happened? The answer is nobody. But Yahshua Yishlach Elav Sar Chamishim Acher V'Chamishav. He sends another group of 50. Again, the same message. Now, if you're Eliyahu, you got to be wondering, is this guy an idiot? Why does he keep sending soldiers to get butchered? And what happens? Of course, the fire comes down and eats them up. Okay. So how many messengers has the king sent? Wow. How many groups of messengers?
Three groups.
The first, we're going to find out, to go to the gods. The second and third, we're coming to get Eliyahu. Now, there are two models here that are patterns in Tanakh. The first model is a model that appears throughout Tanakh, which is a model we call Ashlosha V'al Arba'ah. When you do something three times and there's no resolution, the fourth time is the resolution. I'll give you an example. When Delilah and is trying to get the truth out of Shimshon about his strength, he tells her one lie, he tells her a second lie, he tells her a third lie. And then finally, the fourth time, he tells her the truth. Now, it could be that he told her other things, but all the text reports is 1, 2, 3 lies and the truth. When Shmuel comes to anoint a son of Yishai, he gets Eliav, no, he gets Shama, he gets Abia, he gets the three top sons. And then the text quickly skips through, and then there's David. 1, 2, 3, David, even though there's actually 7 sons. When Shmuel has his first prophecy, God speaks to him, he thinks it's Eli, and he comes running. Second time he comes walking. Third time he asks Eli. Fourth time he's told, and he realizes that it's God. 3 + 1, same thing here. Excuse me. 3 sets of agents that are sent by the king, and none of them work. Now, the fourth one, there's going to be a resolution. But now I want to take you to another story that you should also be reminded of here. And this is something that Yerzakovich refers to as Sipurei Bevuah, mirror stories in Tanakh. I want you to think about a time when a king sent messengers to go bring in an undesirable competitive leader. And they were unsuccessful. Do you remember when Shaul was trying to kill David? And David was still at home. And Shaul sent messengers to get him from his home and kill him. That's when Michal lowers him out the window. And there's a whole scene there where David runs to Ramah, where Shmuel is. And Shaul sends a group of soldiers to get David. As soon as they get there, you know what happens? They're seized by the spirit of prophecy that Shmuel is leading a prophetic exercise. Shaul sends a second group. They're seized by the spirit of prophecy. Shaul sends a third group, seized by the spirit of prophecy. Finally, Shaul says, you want a job done, do it yourself. He goes to go kill David, and he's seized by the spirit of prophecy. And while all these guys are having their ecstatic moment, David runs away. Same thing here. Notice the fire coming down from heaven is like the spirit of prophecy. And they're seized by it. Here they're devoured by it. So similar kind of stories, except these guys don't make it, right? And now the fire. Now watch what happens. He sends a third group to get him, which means for group number 4 now. He bows down in front of Eliyahu. Now, when did he get this? Ahaziah didn't tell him to do this, but he knows what's happened. He probably sees a bunch of burned up corpses. Please have mercy on the 50 of us. Now, of course, Eliyahu could say, why'd you show up at all? King said, fire came down, devoured the last two groups. Please. So now what happens? Up until now, where in the previous Prakim, Eliyahu would decide on his own what to do, like he did in Har Carmel, like he did beforehand. Watch, Eliyahu doesn't move until, by Daber, Malach Adonai El Eliyahu, Reid Oto Al Tirami Panav. The Malach says, go to him, go down with him, and don't be afraid of him. Vayakum Bayer Oto Melach, and he goes with him to the king. In other words, Eliyahu now goes because these guys recognize who he is. And they don't confront him, they beseech him. So he comes down, and he's representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he's walking right into the lair, right into Ahaziyahu's house. And now, by the very law, Ko Amar Adonai, Ya'an Asher Shalachta Malachim Ed Lidrosh Bevav Zvug Elohei Akron. You sent messengers to ask Baal Zvug. And I believe in Israel, Lidrosh Bevaro, Achemita Shalit Hashem Atarim Melachim Atamut. Same message. You're not going to get out of your bed. And then what happens? Vayamot Kibra Adonai Shalit Beliyahu. The king died the same way he said. And Nochi Aram Tachtav, and his son Yoram took over for him, right? Right. Okay, good. And that's the story of Ahaziah. But notice that Eliyahu now has changed, and now we move to the story in which Eliyahu is going to disappear. Take a look at this last chapter that deals with Eliyahu. The way that Eliyahu leaves the world speaks so much to his entire career that we've studied about the last three, these 2.5 weeks. Vahi mahalot Adonai Eliyahu basa'ara hashamayim. Notice, Eliyahu is going to go up in a whirlwind. Remember the three signs? The whirlwind, the fire, and the earthquake. Keep that in mind. God is going to bring Eliyahu up in a whirlwind. What happens? Vayelech Eliyahu ve'elisha min ha-Gilgal. Okay. We have to talk for a moment about place names in Israel. when I say Gilgal, what are you thinking of? When I mention the name Gilgal, where is it?
Yericho.
Okay, so there's Gilgal right near Yericho. As a matter of fact, if you drive up Road 90 today, you'll see on your right side, right north of when you pass Yericho, the sign says Gilgal. And that may be built biblical Gilgal where Yoshua camped for the first few years. There are at least 5 different places called Gilgal in Israel. Why would a place be called Gilgal? What kind of name is that? So let me take you back somewhere else. Where is Beit Lechem? Beit Lechem, Bethlehem, where is it?
Well, it's near Efrat, and whose territory is it? I guess Yehuda. Right, sure.
Yehuda. So why is it called Beit Lechem Yehuda, for instance, in Root? Uh-huh. Because there are other Beit Lechems. There's a Beit Lechem Zevulun, uh-huh, and there's a Beit Lechem Binyamin. Why would there be a Beit Lechem Yehuda and a Beit Lechem Zvulun and a Beit Lechem Binyamin? Why would any town be called a Beit Lechem? Simply
greenery.
Because, what?
Greenery.
Because it's surrounded by fields of grain. Think about Boaz. And in the middle, there's a town where they process the grain, trade it, mill it, etc. Bake it. Beit Lechem. Interesting. Where's Beit Shemesh?
Beit Shemesh near Yerushalayim?
Right. And then there's another Beit Shemesh up in the north of Naphtali. Why is the town called Beit Shemesh?
Can the sun shine a lot?
That could be said about everywhere. It's actually a place where there used to be a cult that worshipped the sun. That's why it's Beit Shemesh. Right? There's sun worshippers. And there's one up in Naphtali, and there's one in Yehuda. We know Beit Shemesh. In other words, place names in Israel are not necessarily unique. They may be describing the agriculture nearby. They may be describing the business nearby. They may be describing the topography. So, for instance, there is a town called Ramah. Where is Ramah? We know Ramah because Kol B'Ramah Nishma. Where is Ramah?
Us being near Beit Lechem, is it?
Right. So there is a Ramah, which is just north of Yerushalayim. It's a town called Aram. It's in the territory of Binyamin. There's another Ramah much further north than that that's called Ramat Ephraim. And that, by the way, is the Ramah of Shmuel HaRamati. Mm-hmm. Shmuel lives, right? Shmuel HaRamati, Ramah. Why is a place called Ramah? What's a Ramah?
Probably high place.
Right. So it's what we call in English, it's a Spanish word, we call it a mesa. You know what a mesa is? It's a mountain with a flat top.
High.
Mm-hmm. It's a flat top. That's what it reminds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What's a Gilgal? Gilgal is a place that has a lot of round stones. So there's Gilgal next to the Ardain. There's another Gilgal near Shechem. If you look at in Sefer Dvarim, Mul HaGilgal Eitzel Elonei Moreh.
Uh-huh.
There's another Gilgal in the Sharmon called, which there's an Arab town there called Gilgilia. There are a few places called Gilgal. You will see that this Gilgal in Pasuk Aleph is not the one near the Ardain. It's one up in the mountains. You'll see that in a minute. All right, so Eliyahu and Elisha go to Gilgal. Vayomer Eliyahu Elisha, Shev na po, ki Adonai shlachani ad Beit El. So they go to Gilgal, and from Gilgal he says, I'm going to Beit El. God has sent me to Beit El. Where's Beit El? We know where Beit El is. Beit El is on the way down from Gilgal down towards the center. And so you stay here and wait for me, or you stay here. I'm going. I want you to remember that. Chai Hashem is how Eliyahu starts his career. Elisha says, by God, I am not going to leave you. They come to Beit El. What's in Beit El? What's Eliyahu doing? By Itzu V'nei HaNevi'im. Now, who are B'nei HaNevi'im? We talked about this a little bit at the very beginning of the series. Who are B'nai HaNevi'im? So B'nai HaNevi'im, which is also the group that Shmuel was doing that exercise with, I just mentioned, are Navi students, people who have dedicated themselves to try to achieve Nivuah, and they do meditation practices and studies and whatever it may be, and they live really very poor lives, and they follow the Navi. So Shmuel had B'nai HaNevi'im, Eliyahu had B'nai HaNevi'im, Elisha had B'nai HaNevi'im. There's a lot of stories of B'nai HaNevi'im with Elisha. So the B'nai HaNevi'im come out, Asher Beit El, that live in Beit El, El Elisha. Don't you know that today God is taking your master away from you? In other words, evidently, Eliyahu's imminent leaving was now well known throughout the prophetic community. He said, yeah, I know, be quiet. Now Eliyahu says, God has sent me to Yericho. You stay here. And what does Elisha say? And again, think 3+1 here. Right? I'm not going to leave you. They get to come together to the town of Yericho. The town of Yericho, by the way, has been rebuilt. Remember, by Chiel Beit Eli. His sons died. It's been rebuilt. So there's a community there. He comes to Yericho. There are B'nai Nevi'im there. They come out. So what's Eliyahu doing? This is a farewell tour. He's going to say goodbye to his students in Gilgal, in Beit El, in Yericho. They say the same thing. You see the pattern. God has sent me to go into the Yarden. Stay here. And what does Elisha say? I'm not leaving you. By a Chushneim, they come down to the Yarden. Now, you know what's going to happen here, so I want to take a minute to talk about it. Eliyahu is going to go into the Yarden, and from the Yarden, he's going to disappear. Where is he going? He's gone Gilgal, Beit El, Yericho, Yarden. What's he doing? So I'm going to start from a whole different place. When you get an Aliyah LaTorah, how do you approach? What route do you take to get up to the place where they're reading from? How do you make your approach? What?
There's a certain side you have to, and for the right.
You have to come. Actually, the halakha is just to take the quickest way, not to make people wait. When you're done, what are you supposed to do? When you're done, you've had your Aliyah, you've stood there for the next Aliyah, now you go down. How do you go down?
Longest way.
So the halakha is you're supposed to circumnavigate the bima. You're supposed to go around. Think about this. When you take a Sefer Torah out, what way do you walk? You walk typically counterclockwise, and it usually is, but you walk in one direction. When you return it, how do you go?
All right, then you go around the whole shul.
You complete the circle, right? You complete the circle. Why? And we're actually mocking on that. Somebody brings a Sefer Torah out. Somebody, let's say, doesn't know the shul. They're not used to it. They're nervous. They carry the Sefer Torah one way, and then when they're done, they carry the Sefer Torah and they go backwards. We stop. No, go that way. We're not beat on it. Because there's a symbolism to the way you walk. When you walk somewhere and then you retrace your steps, the message is, I'm erasing my steps. I wish I was never here. When Abraham went down to Mitzrayim, and then when he returned, Chazal tell us he returned exactly following the same steps. Because what he was trying to do was erase Galut, erase the whole experience. But if you make a full circle, you're making that a proper thing. I wanted to be here. I want to be here reading the Torah. I want the Torah. I want to experience this, so I want to make a full circle. We'll see what I mean here. When Bnei Israel entered the land, how did we enter? Under Yeshua, how did we enter? We crossed the Jordan. What was the first town we conquered? The first town.
Or Guga.
The first town. Was Yericho. Right? Y'all know the Elvis Presley song? Joshua fit the battle. It's Memphis. You must know the Elvis Presley song. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. He's a great version. All right? From Yericho, what was the next battle they fought? Somebody just mentioned it.
Ai.
Which is right next to Beitel. And from there, where did they go? At the end of Parakhet and Yeshua, they went up to Shechem to do the Brit. That's Gilgal. Notice what Eliyahu is doing. What is Eliyahu doing? He's starting in Gilgal, going to Beitel, going to Yericho, going to the Jordan. He is retracing and backing up the steps of the entry to the land. He's going back to the beginning. And now he's in the Jordan. Everything's being reversed. Now watch what happens. But you're the way they are. Sorry. So just Elisha and Eliyahu are at the Jordan. So he takes his cloak out and he hits the water. And the water splits. They're standing on dry land in the middle. This should remind us, of course, of Moshe and also of Yehoshua splitting, you know, stopping the water. But here it's more like Moshe. As they're passing through, all right, ask for your last wish because I'm leaving. Whether that means I want twice as much as you have or I want the main portion like a bechor, interesting machloket. You'll make Shita Lishol. So the Eliyahu says to him, you've asked for a huge thing, to have my spirit on you. If you actually see me as I disappear, then it'll happen. That'll be a sign that you are worthy to get it. All right, here's what goes on. They're walking. A fiery chariot with fiery horses of fire, come down from heaven and separate Eliyahu from Elisha. Vayal Eliyahu basara shamayim. And Eliyahu gets on in this chariot, and he's taken up in a whirlwind up to heaven. There's your wind, there's your fire. The man who brought fire down to Har Carmel, the man who breathed fire, ends up being taken up to Shamayim in fire. And in the wind, which is this wind of terror, that we heard about in Perek Yutet. And Elisha's response is, Avi, Avi, and he weeps, and he tears his clothes because Eliyahu is gone. Where is Eliyahu? Interesting, Machlok of Rishonim. Does Eliyahu go up to heaven and must die, because anybody who goes up there must die? Or did God drop him somewhere else, and he's still alive doing stuff? Big Machlok about how we understand Eliyahu in the Agadot and all. But watch what happens here. Elisha immediately takes his cloak and he puts it down and he splits the water. And there, the Bnei Navim see, Elisha has the spirit of Eliyahu, and they become loyal to him. And we go from there, and the first thing he does is heal the waters of Yericho. And then on his way up to Beit El, another miracle happens, and he's doing miracles along the way. Elisha has certainly taken the mantle of Eliyahu. We have a couple minutes left. I want to make two important comments here. One that comes back to the beginning of our very first year. I asked you when we encounter Eliyahu, and you said we encounter Eliyahu at every bris, at every Seder, and on Motzei Shabbat. Traditionally, those are the three times that we encounter Eliyahu. And most notably, we do not invite him into our sukkah. He's not one of the ushbizim. Interesting. So I want to just comment on that. I'm actually going to take the text off so I can see you guys full screen a little bit for the last couple minutes. There we go. And just to observe about what it is that is going on here with Eliyahu. Eliyahu was the teacher of fire. Eliyahu was the man who breathed fire. And it was successful in certain cases, very temporarily, with a limited success. And God's question of Eliyahu, which is Malacha for Eliyahu, is, what are you doing here? You should be with the people. You should be leading them. And Eliyahu's statement was, Ki azvu b'ritcha b'nei Yisrael, they've abandoned you. And we said at the beginning that there's Yonah, who was zealous for God's honor, but not zealous for B'nai Israel's honor, but not God's. And Eliyahu was zealous for God's honor and not B'nai Israel's. Eliyahu disappears, and we would normally think if he didn't die, he must have been some amazing tzaddik, like Hanoch, who doesn't just go straight up to heaven. I think it's not like that. I think it's different. I think the fact that Eliyahu has to show up at every brit, where he sees that the father is bringing the son into the Masorah. And he has to come to every Seder that he sees the father teaching the son, Torah, and transmitting it to him, is the essential statement. Eliyahu badmouthed B'nai Yisrael. And therefore, at every occasion when you see the power of the banim, the power of the children, and the power of the relationship between the father and children, and the love between the father and children, that's where Eliyahu has to come and testify. Eliyahu has to come and testify against himself. I see that I was wrong. And this comes to fruition in a very powerful and famous pasuk, which I'll show you, which we will end, at the very, very end of the Nevi'im. At the end of the Nevi'im, we have these two psukim. Hinei Anochi Sholeach Lachem Et Eliyahu Navi. I didn't share it with you. I apologize. Hinei Anochi Sholeach Lachem Et Eliyahu Navi. God says, I am going to send you Eliyahu. Lifnei Bo Yom Adonai HaGadol V'Anora. Before the great day of God. So we see Eliyahu is the one who's going to tell us Mashiach is coming. But what is he going to do? Ve'eshiv lev avot al banim, ve'lev banim al avotam. He's going to restore the hearts of the children to the parents and the parents of the children. Whatever that may mean, and that is a shir by itself. Eliyahu is seen here as somebody whose job it is to not only bring about, but also to be witness to the unification of the banim and the avot. And the unification of the banim and avot may also be the banim, Bnei Yisrael, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Eliyahu, therefore, is mandated to show up at every brit, to show up at every Seder, and to come every Motzei Shabbat when we anticipate Biyat HaMashiach, when we've experienced the day which is Me'in Olam Haba, and we anticipate Biyat HaMashiach, and we say to Eliyahu has to come, and Eliyahu has to see how much the children yearn for their father. To see that his claim about us, Azvu B'itcha B'nei Yisrael, is a wrong claim, and that B'nei Yisrael really are loyal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's been a delight studying with you, and I hope that your appreciation for the stories of Eliyahu is grown, and look forward to seeing you in the future.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Very much. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Thank you very much for your presentation. The question is, when it's promised that Achav's blood will be licked up, but in the end, it's not that he's somehow strewn on the ground. Rather, the chariot that he was on, when they were washing it, some of the blood got mixed in the water. So then the dogs came, they were drinking the water. It seems that he escaped the full punishment because of his, perhaps his truva.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it could be his chuah, and it could be also his valiant act at the end. Because had he not done that, he would have just been brought back exactly like that and died, and his blood would have been all over. So it could have been that his own bravery at the end, in order to help Am Yisrael win a victory he wouldn't be able to see, was also the zchut that helped him with that. So the technical prophecy was fulfilled, but you're right, not the full spirit of the prophecy. Thank God. Yeah. Okay. Enjoy a beautiful winter, and I hope to see you guys in the future.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Really learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Very interesting.